You're listening to WPSU State College, WPSX Kane. I'm Patty Satalia with you for this next hour for a live panel discussion. In the wake of the recent child sex scandal, Penn State has found itself under the national magnifying glass on This American Life and every other media outlet. As the world examines Penn State, Penn Staters begin to examine themselves. What happens when a community that is defined and dominated by its university is embroiled in a scandal and alleged cover-up that goes back more than a decade? Reactions have ranged from riot to candlelight vigil. We're also hearing about some who are coming forward for the first time with their own stories of abuse, inspired by those who've spoken out in this instance. Here to talk with me about the community's reaction to the events of the last 2 weeks are Michael Barabay, the Paterno Family Professor in Literature and Director of the Institute for the Arts and Humanities at Penn State. He's also a well-known commentator on the humanities and on academia in venues ranging from the Chronicle of Higher Education to the New York Times. Damon Sims is the Vice President of Student Affairs and an affiliate associate professor in both the Dickinson School of Law and the College of Education at Penn State. He's also a licensed attorney. And Rowan Nasser, a Penn State senior majoring in journalism. She's a discussion facilitator in Sam Richards' sociology course, World in Conversation. Richards, who is a senior lecturer, challenges students to talk candidly about their beliefs and attitudes on issues ranging from race, gender, alcohol consumption, and more recently, this scandal. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I think it's safe to say that it's been a tough couple of weeks to be a Penn Stater, the nation's most popular university based on the number of applications for enrollment, is now the nation's most infamous news story. The firestorm is causing a sort of identity crisis. So I want to begin with Michael Barabay. How have the past 2 weeks affected you personally, directly?
Well, I've had friends check in on me, and I tell them that in all of this mess, you know, the feelings of the Paterno professor are pretty much the least important thing I can think of. That said, here's what happened when I was actually out of town the weekend the news broke, and I was out of town because I was representing Penn State and the Institute for the Arts and Humanities at the Chicago Humanities Festival. Another irony there is that we were only there because we joined the Big Ten. It was Big Ten schools doing various presentations. Susan Squire and I did this presentation on the boundaries of life in the age of biomedicine. 200 people came. They loved it. We were actually, I'm going to sound silly, we were Penn State proud. And we come back and it felt like we were coming back to a crater in the earth.
Damon Sims.
Well, Patty, this has absolutely consumed my life for the last 2 weeks, being a part of the President's Council, occupying Old Main. There is nothing that we have really been able to do other than to deal with this issue. I, of course, have lost my supervisor, the man who brought me to Penn State just 3 years ago. So that's a dramatic change. I don't see much of my family these days. I spent today in my office toiling away on issues related to this concern. But perhaps the thing that stands out for me most profoundly is that being at Penn State only 3 years and having spent 33 years of my life before coming here at another Big Ten institution.
Indiana University,
yes, right. I think I found my emotional connection to Penn State this week. I became a Penn Stater, particularly at the candlelight vigil, standing on the top steps of Old Main, looking out on our students and others, and that expression of very heartfelt, sincere concern for the true victims of this whole episode really bonded me in a fashion with the institution that perhaps I hadn't been bonded with before.
And it might be worth adding that as an attorney, you have worked on child abuse cases.
That's exactly issues. Right. Yes. I have never formally practiced law, but a licensed attorney ought to do something with that license. And so back in Indiana, I spent time representing the interest of children in these kinds of circumstances.
Rowan Nasser, how has the last 2 weeks affected you directly?
Well, for me, it was the candlelight vigil had the same effect on me. I mean, I've been here for 3 years. I'm an international student, so I never really felt that Penn State pride that everyone was talking about all through the 3 years. So, I mean, when I went to the candlelight vigil, and I actually took my camera with me because I wanted to document it, But, I mean, once they started chanting, "We are Penn State," I remember putting the camera down, putting my hand over the lens and thinking, I am Penn State. So at the same time, you know, I've been struggling with how to move forward as a student while giving respect to the victims and their families. So,
you were a facilitator, I mentioned, at the, mm-hmm. the top of the hour in Sam Richards' World of Conversation class. Tell us a little bit about the conversations that you're engaging students in campus-wide. Mm-hmm. What are they like? How do you get them started? And is it easy to get kids talking?
They're very emotional, so it's very easy to get them to start talking. I mean, even before we did, even before we started talking about the scandal, you know, the students didn't want to talk about anything else. So, I mean, it was very emotional for them. They were very confused, and it appeared to me, at least, that they were coming from, you know, two extreme ends of the spectrum, so...
What are the two extremes? And I'm wondering what they're focused on. What's most of their attention and emotion focusing on?
Well, I mean, most of the students were outraged by, you know, the firing of Joe Paterno. But at the same time, you know, those were the students who were, you know, who were raised in State College. So, you know, they've been bleeding, you know, blue and white their entire lives. So this was a huge deal for them, and also for the students who had, you know, friends and family in the football team. But at the same time, you know, you have mostly international students or, you know, people that can be a little detached from, you know, this Penn State spirit that are just, you know, completely confused by why the students are rioting in the streets and, you know, reacting this strongly to, you know, the football coach instead of the victims and, you know, the scandal as a whole.
Michael Barabay mentioned getting a number of emails when this scandal broke. What kind of input were you getting from friends and especially from people at home?
My mother called me and she asked me if I was okay. I mean, I think we were like on the major news, and it just seemed funny to me that I had to explain to her that Joe Paterno had nothing, like he wasn't the center of the scandal. So, I mean, and she's in Saudi Arabia, so that was a big deal.
The whole country, it seems, has weighed in on this scandal. And in the last week, more and more Penn Staters are speaking up as well. In a recent New York Times op-ed piece, Michael Barabay, you said that even before the Sandusky scandal, Penn State was mischaracterized. Its students are smarter, its faculty much better than the sports party perception that abounds. And I'm wondering, why do you suppose that's the case? And what can be done to correct that if that is the misperception?
I don't know what can be done to correct it, but I hope that coming out of this, we've learned something about the downside of having that strong an emotional connection to the football team. Now, I say that even though I try to acknowledge in that piece that what Penn State did was fairly unique. It was trying to ride football as a way of enhancing its academic profile. I alluded to our joining the Big Ten. That actually changed a great deal around here. I wasn't around when it happened. I was teaching at the University of Illinois. Excuse me. But there are two things. One, a lot of the undergraduates who come here, not only the international students, but within the U.S., 40% of our students come from out of state. And they come from out of state not because we have a fifth or sixth ranked English department or number one ranked anthropology department, but because they associate the place with football and with school pride in a more general way. I taught a freshman seminar, a couple of years ago, and it was in the fall, so people had just arrived. And I asked all of them, why did you come here? Almost every single one cited school spirit. And it wasn't just about football. It was also about THON, which is the charity for pediatric cancer, the largest thing like it in the country. They associated this campus with that feeling not only of pride in athletic achievement, but sort of esprit de corps. Now, how to take that feeling, that esprit de corps, how to take that identity and connect it to something else? You know, I used to say as director of the Institute for the Arts and Humanities, most of our alumni don't know we have an Institute for the Arts and Humanities. What would it be like if people said, Penn State, you know, that's that place where that Institute for the Arts and Humanities does this, or the Center for the Performing Arts, which is pretty awesome, to associate Penn State with the things that we actually do day in, day out that have, you know, not on the athletic side at all.
You mentioned school spirit, and I have to ask, have any of you ever chanted, "We are Penn State"? And if you have, what did it mean to you? I'll begin with you, Michael.
Oh, me again. I've been to a couple of games, and that feeling of having 110,000 people say something in unison, and not just "We are Penn State," but the closing, you know, "Thank you, you're welcome," I find quite charming. But a friend of mine in the comparative literature department recently was telling us that Among the ways to have, you know, pride in other things that Penn State does, he actually concluded a class that he thought was the best class he'd ever been in his life. I mean, the students were just terrific. The discussion was fabulous. And he said, folks, that was great. We are. And students didn't associate the chant with class. I mean, they sort of confusedly said Penn State. And I think that it would be interesting to see what it would be like to have an identity built around, wow, that was a great class we just took. We are Penn State.
Damon Sims.
Well, I must admit that when I've been at football games a couple of times, I've certainly chanted, we are Penn State. When my window is open at Old Main, I quite often have students walking by who spontaneously yell, we are Penn State. And the charm of it is usually there, but there are days when it becomes so repetitive and sort of empty that I wonder about it. But I think it's one of those phrases that has a potency, a power within the Penn State family. But I've had conversations with folks recently in which I've suggested that beyond Penn State, beyond central Pennsylvania, beyond the state of Pennsylvania at least, there is a perception that I've had shared with me that the We Are Penn State phrase has embedded in it a certain hubris, a lack of humility that otherwise might be more charming.
Rowan.
Well, for me, I mean, I already mentioned, you know, I'm an international student from Saudi Arabia. So for the longest time, We Are Penn State really meant nothing to me. And it was just something my, you know, drunk friends would start chanting after midnight. But, I mean, as I mentioned, it wasn't until the candlelight vigil that that phrase actually meant something to me. But I feel that's because I couldn't really relate to the students that were huge football fans. And because We Are Penn State comes from this culture of football, I feel that's where, you know, that's why the students are grieving the most.
Well, why do you think there has been so much focus on Joe Paterno as opposed to others who are implicated in this case? Damon Sims.
Well, I think, you know, that says something about Penn State, but it says something about the society within which Penn State resides. It is a curious phenomenon in American culture that sport generally has a much more powerful influence on people than some of us would like to see. But, you know, I may be the only person in the country who had a front row seat for the firing of Joe Paterno and the firing of Bob Knight. So when I was at Indiana, I was also in the middle of that departure, and so I sort of understand how this can happen in various places, in the potency of sport and the commitment that people have to their sports teams in these places is truly extraordinary. And I think that some of the things that Michael was talking about the greatness of Penn State being far more than football. And truly, the greatest parts of Penn State are not in the football program, I don't think, but sort of being disappointed that people don't recognize that. I could say the same thing about my experience at Indiana, where the powerful connection was to Bob Knight and the basketball program and not one of the world's great music schools, for instance.
One of the things you point out in your New York Times op-ed piece, Michael Barabay, is the fact that we're known as the number one party state on one hand and not so well known for the fact that we rank among the top 10 for sociology, English, and anthropology programs.
Which is all quite recent, by the way. I mean, the last time those rankings were done, English placed number 42. Now, if the football team had gone from 42 to 5, that would be something, right? And so it testifies to like a long-term commitment not only to faculty but to graduate programs, to teaching, and all of that. I just want to underscore that. I mean, I came from Illinois. Illinois actually has the third largest library in the country. In the country, right? After the Library of Congress and Harvard. Do you think anyone in rural Illinois around Urbana-Champaign cared about that? You take a step 15, 20 miles in any direction around here. It's not just, I'm not talking about the alumni and the students, the surrounding community.
They don't care about this library.
They associate Penn State with the football team. It's, you know, you've got a Penn State flag up and you've got a Steelers flag up. I'm not even going to get into the whole Steelers-Eagles thing. But it's not, and of course in Indiana, it's a Hoosier state, right? They're crazy about basketball. Illinois to some extent as well. And that really, it really is a very strange configuration. Other countries don't have anything like it, where it's not just that we put too much emphasis on sport as a society, but they are embedded in some university's entire image. And that really is, it can have some deleterious effects if you're sitting watching Bobby Knight or Joe Paterno
In an op-ed piece that Russell Frank, a communications professor, wrote, Mission Possible, Restoring Penn State Pride, which appeared in statecollege.com, he talked about the fact that here we are, this university that's considered a research giant, and yet there's no bookstore in town. How do you, I guess I'm wondering, what attracted you, Damon Sims, 29 years in the field of student affairs, most of those at Indiana University in Bloomington, a fine university, what attracted you to Penn State in the first place?
Well, it was not the absence of bookstores in town, and it wasn't the dining scene in State College. But I can tell you that, I think that Penn State is among the great public universities in the land, and I think the Big Ten, the CIC collection, is certainly filled with those kinds of institutions. Penn State struck me as a place that was extraordinarily well managed. It had the rhetoric of student-centeredness, which for the Vice President for Student Affairs is a very attractive thing. Graham Spanier is a compelling, charismatic figure. There are all these pieces in place. Penn State is also more than just the University Park campus. It's campuses throughout the Commonwealth, which makes for a very interesting dynamic for the role that I have. But I was attracted here not because of the athletic program. I had come from an institution that was very much like this one and had a great athletic program. That's an accoutrement that's pleasant to have, but I was really here because these are great students working with great faculty in an institution that cares deeply, I think, about those experiences, and as Michael has said, has grown enormously in a relatively short time span to become one of the great universities of the land.
You wanted to add something, and then I want to follow up to something that Damon said.
Sure, I just wanted to explain some inside baseball. The CIC is the not very sexily named Committee on Institutional Cooperation. It's the Big Ten schools plus the University of Chicago. Everyone says this was all about protecting the football program and it was all about the money. I just wanted to say, I'm sure there was a great deal of it. But joining the Big Ten was not about that. I wasn't here when that decision was made, again. But the idea was that Penn State could have gone on pretty much forever just competing with Notre Dame for T-shirt sales. You know, if it were just about football, but Bryce Jordan, Joe Paterno, then after them, the next two presidents, right up to Graham Spanier, said, no, Big Ten's a strong academic conference. Now we have to compete with Michigan and Northwestern. And as a result of being in the CIC, one of the things they do is they circulate PhDs to other institutions. So, in fact, it was an Indiana PhD who was my research assistant for a semester. And the quality of students coming out of the great public universities is just that strong. It's one of the things that actually made Penn State better.
Well, I'd like you to comment on something that Matt Jordan, who's a professor of media studies, wrote in a Huffington Post op-ed recently. And that was really that the problem with Penn State and football is that Penn State, on the academic side, came to rely on the football, just as the underprivileged children in Second Mile did. In other words, with federal and state funding dwindling, they had to rely on the kindness of strangers to survive. Do you buy that theory?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and especially in the arts and humanities, we're basically going over to the patronage system. I mean, if we can only – look, we already have the highest tuition of any public university in this country. We just can't keep going to that well. And out-of-state tuition, that's some serious – it's expensive.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Yeah. Dude, yeah, you must have been out there. Okay, so sorry, as if you don't know. But I think a lot of people don't. I think a lot of people still think that state universities are actually funded by the state, that they're accessible to all, and that we haven't reneged on that promise of public education to the extent that we have. And that means more and more of the funding has to be private. That means that basically we have to make sure we don't alienate potential patrons. We're back and go to the neo-Medici model of funding.
Which makes the children in Second Mile and also Penn State vulnerable. Now, I want to follow up on something that Damon Sims said a moment ago. He said something about great students. And this question is for Rowan, because after this scandal broke, there was a letter published in the Daily Collegian. It was written by a guy by the name of Gregory White of Austin, Texas, and he wrote, quote, "No one from Penn State will ever be hired by any company I run in the future. I am sickened beyond belief by the disgusting support of pedophilia shown by Penn State students." Mm-hmm. How concerned are students of the stigma that could be attached to them because of all of this?
Well, I mean, we've talked about this scandal in a lot of my classes, and that's, you know, that's one of the issues the students are always bringing up. But I feel like there's a bit of, you know, some denial going on because they don't realize that they are stigmatized by this. They still feel like they should be judged as individuals and not as people that are affiliated with this university or, you know, with the scandal. So, I mean, it is a big deal for them, but they still don't know exactly how to deal with it.
Do you have a comment for that, Damon Sims? Do you think this is going to have lasting implications for students who will be entering a very tough job market to begin with?
No, I don't. We have worked very hard through our Career Services Office and others to reach out to talk to the most likely employers of our students to see how they're feeling about things.
In fact, there's a letter on the website right
exactly.
now that says, please have an open mind about our students.
That's right. And I think that it's clear that the indication is that most credible employers are not characterizing all Penn State students on the basis of this affair, or even sort of monolithically grouping all Penn State students into that collection that took to the streets. A very, very small percentage of our students were actually involved in activities that were so troubling that night. So I think that the most fair-minded people who are going to be the ones employing our students are still focused on the fact that the essence, the bones of the institution remain very strong. So the faculty, as Michael is representative of and Rowan is representative of our students, those folks continue to do what they do in the classroom and beyond in terms of learning and discovery, just as they did before all this occurred. And I think that when the Wall Street Journal cited us as the place that corporations first go for their next group of employees, they did so on the basis of those elements, not on the basis of our football program or any of the things that are at the core of this particular issue.
You said a moment ago that part of what attracted you to Penn State was that it was well managed. And I think you know better than anyone, being in administration, that perhaps the harshest criticism right now from the outside world is leveled at university administrators as they see it perpetuating a code of silence, operating in a top-down fashion, and lacking this collective moral compass that everyone everywhere seems to be talking about. And of course, those are simplistic stereotypes, but how can the university come to grips with what others are saying, and what changes from where you're sitting are needed for the university to go forward?
Well, I think we have to embrace in our actions the words that we're now stating. We're talking about transparency. We're talking about openness. We actually have to behave in ways that are transparent and open. We are now subject to a number of reviews. They're external. They are internal. We need to embrace all of those. I don't know about others, but I'm largely left to speculate about what happened, despite being inside the organization and being very close to many of the individuals involved. And I think, as someone noted in the paper today, speculation is easy and knowledge is hard won. I think we're going to have to go through a period of very deep reflection and self-criticism and try to identify what did go wrong? What systemically must we change in order to avoid having any of these things happen again? And our focus, first and foremost, I think, must be on the victims and survivors and trying to determine what we as an institution can do to support them, to support others who are similarly situated. I think that would give some meaning for this experience for our students, who quite often are seeking opportunities to reach out to others and do good things. I think we've now identified a cause that we collectively could rally around and make a real difference in the world.
As investigative journalist Walter Brash wrote, the more TV crews that showed up on campus, the more, in his opinion, the reporting sank. And that sort of speaks to your comment about still some speculation. But I want to follow up with you, Michael Barabay, because up until last Friday's Faculty Senate meeting, some said that much of Penn State's faculty seemed placid, almost timid about this in the face of this.
Well, also horrified.
Horrified as well, as probably. But the Faculty Senate called for an independent investigation. There's talk about all kinds of investigations, but they're asking for an investigation involving people outside of Penn State.
Right.
And I actually want to play two clips that came from that and then get your reaction to it.
Sure.
In my view, every single person in this room, and I think every single member of our faculty, has been diminished by this. And so I think that's prima facie evidence that we do have an interest in this.
If what we're concerned about is the questions about the independence and impartiality of the special committee as constituted, why aren't we saying that and then calling on the university to have an independent special committee in accordance with the requirements there, namely a chair and majority of members who are unconnected with Penn State?
Michael Barabay, your comments?
Well, first I want to identify the second speaker, a friend of mine, Jonathan Marks, who was a barrister in Scotland, and I think that comes through. And what he's saying is that the Faculty Senate here is walking a fine line. The Board of Trustees has already launched an investigation. Faculty Senate wants an investigation that is completely independent, right? And I think that's the right way to go. I also made this suggestion in my op-ed that it was the right thing to do for President Erickson to mention hiring an ethics officer, but not an ethics officer that reports directly to the president. Now, I'm a little bit out of my area of expertise. I might want to turn this over to the attorney in the room. But I do have a friend who works on exactly this kind of thing, these kind of institutional disasters. And he assures me that that whole idea of an ethics officer will work only if it's truly independent, like an ombudsperson, and does not answer directly up the chain of command. Otherwise, you're just adding another link in the chain of command. Now, if this wakens, one quick thing. This is the first time in my life over the last weekend that I've been called naive. Usually, I bring the cynicism to the party. And people are saying that my suggestion that the faculty should be more involved, that there should be faculty ethics committee independent of administration, is just silly. Well, first of all, it's true that faculty senates have just dwindled. There's a whole book on this, Benjamin Ginsberg's book, The Fall of the Faculty and the Rise of the All-Administrative University. It is usually the case at places this size that administration administers and the faculty does the research and teaching. But colleagues who've been here longer than I have pointed out to me that back when we had the Rini Portland scandal, this was a homophobic women's basketball coach who was very successful and stayed on for a long, long time, because how could you possibly get rid of a very successful coach? Well, the Faculty Senate actually did vote on that back in 1990 and passed an anti-discrimination statute. The Faculty Senate had the best interests of the institution, I think, in mind well in advance of anything that was actually done to end Rini Portland's tenure here. So it's not as if the Faculty Senate is like the Senate in Star Wars, right? It is in many places. I think the faculty have been totally complicit in their own marginalization, and I hope that changes.
Damon Sims, do you think the Faculty Senate will have and should have a stronger voice?
Well, I think that the request they've made, the recommendation they've made for an independent investigation is actually something we ought to embrace. I don't think that that should be done to the exclusion of all the other investigations that we're subject to. I mean, we're subject to the Department of Education coming in a week and a half or so, the NCAA, Middle States Accreditation, and on and on. And as I said before, I think we need to embrace all of those. We need to be fully—
Really? We need all of them?
Well, I think we can't say no to them. And,
okay.
And I also think it would be interesting because I suspect they will all come to generally
the
same
conclusions. Together, right?
The NCAA, I don't really want the NCAA investigating everything about the institution as Michael and the Faculty Senate might want to investigate the institution. This is a large and complicated place. The NCAA ought to focus on athletics and the degree to which the institution has actually supervised that area, managed it in the way that it should. I think the faculty have another set of interests that ought to be considered. I think that the Department of Education is looking very specifically at the Clery Act compliance issues. These are all very important, and we have to embrace them because we don't have any other choice. I also think that to the degree that we discover what has happened through these processes, we're going to be able to move forward. If we do not learn what has gone wrong here, what mistakes we made, what about the culture needs to be changed, then those changes that are necessary are never going to happen. Now, the one thing I'd say is I think that the ethics officer is a very good idea. I think that reasonable minds can debate issues about where that position should be placed in the organization, to whom it should report. I also would say that in this case, I don't think anybody needed to go to an ethics officer to determine whether some of the things that have been alleged were wrong or right. I think some of this is less nuanced than that.
A no-brainer.
So part of it requires an ethics officer perhaps to get at so that we can avoid some issues in the future. But if we really look at the cold, hard facts that seem to be emerging in this situation, I'm not really sure where the ethics officer would have played in.
I want to follow up with you, Damon Sims, in a moment about scandals that have occurred at other universities. But before doing that, we talked a minute ago about that some have said that the Penn State faculty was placid or timid in the face of this. You said also shocked. I wanted to mention that the New York Times op-ed piece that you did was at a request. You were asked to do an op-ed piece. Did you approach it with trepidation? Oh, I thought they asked
for your thoughts. I got requests from a number of other outlets almost immediately because, as you noted, I do mouth off about things in various publications, not just academic but journalistic and magazines and so forth. And I was just too stunned. I couldn't imagine how anyone could say anything about this that wouldn't make everything even worse for the institution, for the victims, for the families. And I'm still not sure, you know.
But what was the reaction to it, though? Because you've certainly gotten feedback.
So far, overwhelmingly positive. But, you know, look, it's so toxic. I've got some correspondents sending me long emails that can't decide whether I am accessory to child rape after the fact or an actual child rapist. This is such a volatile thing. It's such and one of the things I'm trying to get at, and I think people who are more cynical about Penn State, again, let me go back to something that Rowan said at the very outset. I didn't get the whole school spirit thing either. I mean, I went to a university where people really sort of majored in irony, you know, and sarcasm. And so if you're not part of that culture, you really don't understand that really the emotional connection that people had to Paterno, to the idea that we did college athletics right. And even though there are, you know, flaws here and there, you know, we had never been investigated by the NCAA. Paterno really did kick Joe Juravicius off the team before a bowl game for missing classes.
And he funded, for crying out loud, your department.
And my department.
Your professorship.
You know, Bobby Knight funded a chair. He wasn't in English. Almost nobody funds chairs in English. There was a reason to believe that this was an exception to the rule in big-time college sports. You go from that feeling on Friday to this entire, you know, basically now we're associated with serial child rape and cover-up on Saturday. That's stunning. And I just, words failed me. That's all.
You're listening to WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. It has been 2 weeks since a child sex abuse scandal erupted on the campus of Penn State, shaking the university community to its core. Here to talk about how the university's handling those events is Damon Sims, Vice President of Student Affairs at Penn State and co-chair of the partnership Campus and Community United Against Dangerous Drinking. We'll talk more about that in the next half hour. Also with us is Michael Barabay. He is director of the Institute for the Arts and Humanities and a well-known commentator on the humanities and on academia in venues ranging from the Chronicle of Higher Education to the New York Times. And Rowan Nasser, a Penn State undergraduate student and a facilitator in Sam Richards' sociology course, World in Conversation. Let's talk for just a moment about some of the media press in particular. The radio program, This American Life, boy, I'm losing it. 2 years ago, as you know, Damon Sims, a very popular number one party school episode aired. That was in December of 2009. You've had 2 years since then working on that issue. Tell us a little bit about what you and this partnership, the Campus and Community United Against Dangerous Drinking, what was your reaction to that piece, and what, if anything, has changed as a result of it?
Well, I never thought of that piece as a popular piece. It wasn't all that popular to me, but it certainly was a piece that got a lot of attention and focused our attention even more acutely on the issue, which was very helpful. I must say, you'll have to have me back for another show to talk to you about all the things we're doing to try to mitigate the issue of dangerous drinking among our students. But shortly after that piece ran, I had the opportunity to make a presentation to the Board of Trustees, and I announced the launch of 41 new initiatives at Penn State that were designed to minimize the problem that dangerous drinking poses for our students. Part of that is done in the partnership with the borough and the university working together, but an awful lot of it is done at the university and, importantly, with a lot of student involvement. We have found that student leaders in the last year and a half or so have stepped forward to take ownership of this issue and have been very helpful to us. But I can tell you that we've had some measures recently in our evaluation of these programs, and we're trying to assess the progress that demonstrate that we're actually affecting the problem the way we'd hoped. So the some of the drinking statistics that were mentioned in the This American Life piece, if they came back now, we could show that they're trending in the other direction.
Well, let's get Rowan in here. One of the statistics that they mentioned in This American Life was that every Friday and Saturday, 75% of Penn State students, that's 30,000 students, drink an average of 4.5 drinks in a three-hour period. And half of them are binge drinkers. Have you seen changes since 2009, Rowan?
Well, I mean, 2009 was my first year here. So I didn't go out much. You know, I only turned 21 last year. So, but I mean, I have noticed that whenever we throw like a house party or something, the police would always come and like check on the party, check if there are any, you know, if there are any underage drinkers in the house. And I've noticed that, you know, people are starting to wait until, you know, they turn 21 to start going out. I don't see as many people using fake IDs. I mean, and we do live in a safe campus, so we're never worried about someone who's drunk out of their mind, you know, walking back home. So
that was a very good answer.
there were a number of things that perhaps people didn't know about. Their neighborhood meet and greets. Damon, maybe you can tell us about President Spanier, Elizabeth Gorham, the head of the student government, the Nittany Lions went door to door talking with new students as they moved in. And I'm wondering with what effect?
Well, I think that's a wonderful program, the Lion Walk, which we do at the beginning of each school year. I don't think that program alone is doing a whole lot to minimize the problem of drinking, but I think that we're trying to impress upon students that when they come here, they're actually citizens of this community. They have the rights and the responsibilities of citizenship in our community. We want them to embrace this place as we embrace them, and that's both for students who are living on campus, certainly, and those who are living off campus. You know, this is a huge problem that is not unique to this university. Indiana University was the party school of the year in 2003, so maybe I'm the common factor that's causing this everywhere.
Don't let them
go
move to your campus.
I mean, the fact is that if you're going to make a change, this is another one of those cultural phenomenons that's going to require some persistence over time, and we have to seek some incremental progress in that time, and I think we're starting to see that, but we're going to have to stay with it. It's going to be a long, slow slog, and I'm optimistic about where we can end.
One little addendum to that. I mean, you cited the numbers of students and the statistics about them. What I took away from that program, both in 2009 and again just now, was that there was another story here that had to do with the alumni. And that's a culture that will have to change as well. Because you're right. I saw the same thing in Illinois. I have a friend at Purdue who can't live in that area of West Lafayette because one day she woke up and people next to her built a bonfire that got out of control and they were sort of, you know, cross-eyed. And, you know, it's not unique to Penn State, but I do think that the few times we've tried to push back, and it was before you arrived, the university banned people coming out during the game back into the parking lot and drinking, right? That alone was like the most controversial thing. You know, you could have closed the library. Eh, a couple people would complain, but you know, no drinking during the game. Oh my goodness, this is the human rights issue of our time. That attitude has got to change. And one thought about that, you know, when I do arts and humanities program here, of course I try to avoid home football games because if I'm bringing people to campus, there's no room at any hotels. But I also do a film festival every fall, and Charles Dumas, the School of Theater, suggested to me, you're avoiding the home football game with your film festival. Don't. do your film festival on a home football game, because you're going to find some alumni who actually rather see a classic movie than tailgate for 12 hours.
An interesting point. I want to bring up another quote, basically, or another thought from that op-ed piece by Russell Frank, Mission Possible, Restoring Penn State Pride. He was playing off that popular bumper sticker, State College is a drinking town with a football problem. And he says, basically, if that's the case, then Penn State is a football team with a good university rather than the other way around. And I'll begin with you, Michael Barabay. Is that image accurate, and has it hurt us?
Yes and yes. well, that line, of course, I believe it was an Oklahoma coach who said that he wanted a university the football team could be proud of. Okay, that stands in college athletics as, you know, sort of the distillation of misplaced priorities. And all I was trying to say is that for a long time, if you go back to when Joe Paterno first arrived, it really was a small agricultural college, you know, just nestled in the hills. And even to, you know, the 60s and the 70s, it was a decent regional school. This academic reputation is trying to compete with the major public universities, the great Midwestern publics. That's really quite new. And I think I'm not even sure that a lot of alumni know that. That, you know, the school really had, you know, the value until 2 weeks ago, you know, the value of a Penn State degree had really been increasing. It was a more competitive academic environment, not only on the undergraduate level, but, you know, in graduate, among faculty and so forth. And I don't think that's sunk in. Anyone who formed their opinion of Penn State, you know, 20 or 30 years ago should have checked it. But, you know, of course, most people don't. Their reputation, you know, their impressions had already been solidified.
But I would argue that what is going to change as a consequence of all that we've been through in the last 2.5 weeks is more fundamentally the athletic program. I think the academic programs, the great learning in the classroom, the research that is done, that continues unabated. It wasn't part of the problem. It will not be sullied, I don't think, coming out of the problem. I think that what actually happens is that remains, and we get a chance now, if we do this right, to actually recalibrate the balance between athletics and academics in a way that can be very fruitful, that can elevate in everyone's eyes the prominence of our academic programs and the great success of them, because we do have a story there that I don't think has been told quite as well as it could be. But I think that when people start to realize that really, we can have a successful athletic program without it being the heart and soul of the institution. The heart and soul of the institution is found in the faculty, such as Michael, and the students, such as Rowan. And I think then we will be in the right place.
And yet we did have a football program with the highest graduation rates in the country and a coach whose name was on a library and not on a sports building.
All of which is great, and we should be pleased about that. I think the problem, though, if there is a problem, is when any part of the university, doesn't matter what part it is, becomes so isolated from the rest of the institution that it's sort of an institution unto itself. That's a mistake. And so we need to make sure the athletic program is fully a part of the university, equal partners with everybody else at the university. And I think that is the recalibration that I hope we can achieve.
Okay.
One short thing on that as well. This, too, is historical, right? To put it more colloquially, when did sports get truly insane? All right. The college basketball wasn't all that huge until the famous Magic Bird matchup in 79, and then March Madness became an enormous thing. I think it's really only in the last 20, 30 years that the disproportionate weight of college athletics has gotten really out of control. And maybe this, you're exactly right. This is the time to check on how that happened and how to try to reverse it, see if those cows go back in that barn.
I want to talk about another university scandal. I'm not comparing the scandals because they're very different. And by many accounts, this one here is the worst scandal in the history of higher education and in college sports. But about 5 years ago, Duke University was rocked by a scandal that involved race and sex and privilege, and they came back stronger. And I want to talk a little bit about how Duke regained its reputation Were there lessons learned from that we might apply here, Damon Sims?
Well, I think that the Duke experience should tell all of us that we need to wait until we actually know. For the longest time, Duke was subject to enormous speculation, much of which, in key aspects, proved to be untrue. So I think that there are things that we still need to understand more clearly about this circumstance and reflect upon, have a discussion about. I don't think we should actually rush ahead in search of some sort of normalcy. I think we actually need to wallow a bit in the difficulty that's around us so that we can actually understand it and know it well enough that we can then identify very clearly what the solutions are and then embrace a new path forward. But we need to have some patience in order to do that, and I hate to see us try to get too far ahead by trying to find our way back to what was normal before.
Also, Duke was helped by the fact that the players were, in fact, innocent, and that the real scandal there was a district attorney withholding exculpatory evidence. So you ought to offload a lot of the scandal off campus.
Right.
But I think you're drawing exactly the right lesson here because, and I can't believe I've forgotten to say this so far, the 23-page grand jury presentment, awful as it is a redaction of months and months and months of testimony.
Just a fraction of,
my
of
goodness.
And so the real report.
What we know now is horrible. But again, we only know a fraction of what eventually, and you mentioned all the investigations, there will really be a great deal more come to light. I don't know whether it gets worse before it gets better or it gets worse before it gets even worse than that. I don't know. But we have yet a long way to go.
I want to bring Rowan back into the conversation because one of the things that faculty were encouraged to do when this scandal broke was to talk about this in their classrooms. Mm-hmm. And I talked with a number of professors, and I'll talk about that in a moment, who said this was a real teachable moment. What was your experience? You're a facilitator, I know, mm-hmm. but in your own classes, what happened?
It was really interesting because we got to view the situation from different angles. So, I mean, I remember in one of my social classes, we had Eric Silver come in, who is, I think he teaches a class on sociology mm-hmm. of deviance, and he actually... Instead of avoiding the topic of pedophilia, he actually, just steered into that curve and, talked about how, just about, the culture in general. He didn't, he wasn't really trying to talk about the scandal or the facts. He was just, trying to, treat the situation from another angle. And in our last class, we were talking about being stigmatized and what we can do. And I'm actually really glad that Mr. Sims here said that we need some patience. Before we get back to that sense of normalcy, because I feel like the students need to maybe accept that this has happened and that we can move forward and become better with this.
Are you starting to feel more a sense of normalcy, or do you think it's going to take a couple of more weeks for you and other students? And you don't represent every student, mm-hmm. but I'm wondering where you are in dealing with this.
Well, I feel like I feel like I can speak for the students just because we have been talking to a lot of them during the past 2 weeks. A lot of them are still struggling with the scandal, and I think it's going to take us a bit of time to get back to normal.
I talked with a management professor who looked at this as here now we have this real-world management problem to solve, a communication instructor who says that her students, many of whom were PR majors, that they talked about the golden hour and this time where a company has to do or say something before they lose control of a situation. And one student, she said, who said that when President Rodney Erickson finally started issuing email messages to the Penn State community, he said, I finally realized why Roosevelt's fireside chats were so important. He said, it finally felt like there was an adult in charge. So let's talk about two things. One, how important is what Rodney Erickson does in the next few weeks, and how does everyone, what needs to happen in terms of getting the information out there? What is happening? Because when there's a lack of communication, something is going to fill that void.
Well, I would say that one of the frustrations for those of us in the administration was that we were not allowed, essentially, to say anything. This was first and foremost, or it seemed first and foremost, a legal issue. So without getting into all the complications that presents, there was a great reluctance for anyone to say anything. But you're exactly right, Patty. When you say nothing, there is a void that has to be filled with something. And it was largely in the early going filled with the 23-page redaction that Michael mentioned, which is filled with just horrific stories. And when there was nothing from the administration, there was also a lot of speculation from the media. And I think that Rowan and other students were hearing that and hearing nothing from the leadership of the institution. We've gotten past that phase, and now we have Rod Erickson as a leader, and there is not a more earnest, honest person with greater integrity at Penn State than Rod Erickson. And I think the sincerity of Rod is going to start to show through in a variety of ways, not the least of which is messages that he is going to continue to deliver. I'm very happy that Rod and other colleagues have agreed to accommodate some student leaders, the leaders of the Undergraduate Association, UPUA, the Graduate Student Association, and CCSG, the Commonwealth Campus Student Governments. They've asked us to participate in a town hall forum the Wednesday after Thanksgiving break at 6 p.m. in Heritage Hall for anyone who would like to attend. Rod will be there, and that'll be a chance, I think, for Rod to introduce himself. A lot of students will not have met him, but that's a chance for him to do that. And then for students to ask us any questions they like and for us to respond. I think, again, that's a wonderful opportunity for us to start to demonstrate the kind of openness and communication that Rod exemplifies, I think.
It's going to be a working holiday for a number of people. Michael.
I just wanted to say I don't think any university president has come in under more adverse circumstances in the history of American academia. So I truly wish him well and think he's made the right move so far. I'm wondering what this means for students, because most people don't... Oh, you can ask that.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm
hosting this show. I think it's another inside baseball thing. Most people don't know what a provost is, right? That's why they had no association with Rod Erickson before this.
So I was wondering, what was your first reaction when you got an email that said, Rodney Erickson?
I don't want to say I felt better, but I felt a little bit better when I first read the first statement that that he put out. And I felt like that maybe should have been made like a week earlier. But for the students, I feel like it didn't really make that much of a difference.
You didn't talk about it with students down the hall?
I mean, we did talk about it, but it was before he was officially the president of the university. We had him in one of our classes, Social 19, and, there was the video of him addressing the university. So, I don't know. I mean, we just have to wait and see, I guess, because, I mean, even in the beginning, I felt like there was a bit of a lack of empathy for President Graham Spanier, because the students, I felt, couldn't really relate to him. And, as I said, we have to wait and see.
Let's talk about media fatigue, and I want to just bring something up first, and that is that the Brooklyn Media Studies Group researches how child abuse issues are covered in the media, and they just finished a huge study. But they say that the coverage of Penn State changes everything. They're now working on a new study that will compare and contrast Penn State coverage with how the media coverage covered child sexual abuse up until now. First, I guess I want to start with you, Damon Sims. What are your thoughts on media coverage of this, and why do you think it has been so explosive, so all-pervasive?
Well, you couldn't find a better example of a Greek tragedy in modern America than this one. Our vices, or rather our virtues as an institution, loyalty, sense of family, duty to place, have become our vices, apparently. And we have fallen so far from the perch that we were on, where people look to us as the exemplars of how you do things the right way. And clearly something was amiss. And so this just has all the elements of a real drama that would attract the media to us fairly quickly, I think. And you have players whose names are already familiar. Joe Paterno is a household name across the country, so that makes it relatively easy, too. I would say that with the media, it's hard to be monolithic about them either. I think some have done well, some have done very poorly. And so the inside baseball business is that I often know the facts that are being reported on. And I'm disappointed by the degree to which those facts have been misrepresented, or people have relied upon speculation to report and haven't really been clear that what they're doing is speculating or that others are speculating.
I would let you chime in, Michael Berube, in just a moment. But when something is out in the press and you know it's wrong, for those of us who find out later that it was wrong, and we knew that you knew it was wrong, you know, today, the minute it was issued, why? That's kind of a legal question. Why don't you always just come out and say,
I agree with
this
you.
This is wrong.
I'm a lawyer, married to a lawyer, but lawyers have told us to keep our mouths shut at times. And I think there is a concern. This is a very complicated issue. This involved a continuing open criminal investigation by the Attorney General's office. People in our building were being subject to that in the most excruciating way. And there's also concern about the institution, compromising itself and its own interests, which are the interests of students, faculty, and staff as well, by saying things too precipitously. My view, frankly, is that what would have been better, and it's much easier in hindsight to be able to say this, but what is almost always best in these situations is for the institution to get all the facts out as quickly as it can, the good, the bad, and the ugly, to tell the story itself from its perspective as quickly as it can. We didn't do that. We were on our heels. I think if ever faced with anything like this again, I can assure you that Penn State will react differently. We've learned from this experience. No one, to my knowledge, ever foresaw anything like this happening here. And as a consequence, I don't think we were as prepared as we could have been to respond to it.
There's another element as well we haven't mentioned. That's why I want it's funny you mentioned the Greek tragedy. Someone just wrote to me and said, I hope you have a Sophocles around there. I said, no, actually, I think we may need Euripides, darker, more cynical, because one of the things that facilitated this wasn't just, you know, what administrators did or didn't do at Penn State. It was a charity founded by Jerry Sandusky that was for troubled children, that was his recruitment device. I can't, again, words fail me. I mean, the thing that we all looked up to, I didn't know anything much about the Second Mile. I just sort of admired it. And that element of the story where I just watched this interview with John Amici, the former basketball player, and how horribly he feels having done community service for the Second Mile as a Penn State athlete. And I realized, oh, my God, what was going on here was the use of Penn State's athletic aura to enhance the Second Mile and vice versa.
And yet thousands.
And that's stunning. I mean, it's appalling. It's and so I understand if it's a media feeding frenzy, I got to say it's well-founded.
Stunning, and yet thousands of kids would say they benefited from the Second Mile.
Right. It wasn't all it did, but I mean, it was a front for Sandusky's side, and that's goodness. Among the things I could not possibly have imagined upon reading that report, that's the one that jumped out at me.
You said Damon Sims, a Greek tragedy, and Walter Brash said a tragedy that suddenly became sport, which kind of adds to the. Let's see. What psychologist Peter Montminy wrote, and you've sort of touched on this a little bit, Damon Sims, and that is that nothing can undo what's been done. You know, what we've seen, what we've said, what we've heard. So, what lessons do you hope we take from this very grim chapter in Penn State's history?
Well, you know, I've had experiences in my life that were tragic. My first son died after 11 days of life, and that gives me perspective about anything that comes after that, because for me personally, that's as bad as it gets. What I know about the darkest times in the lives of individuals or institutions is that there are brighter days ahead. But I think what's required of us, what we must do, is to actually take the time to try to discern what we can do for these victims, what we can do for others similarly situated, what we as an institution can commit to help avoid these things happening ever again. We have to have the humility to actually recognize that perhaps we fell short in ways and reflect upon what those ways were so that we can make corrections there. And then we have to have the resolve to see our way through a period that I think is going to be difficult for some time to come. Because each time a court hearing is held and there is some other element of the story that's revealed, we're going to have to return to this. We have a lot of people around us who are in pain because they themselves were victims at some point in their lives of abuse, and they are reliving that experience, and we need to embrace them first and foremost. But I think what we will learn is that Rowan is right. We can come out of this a better institution than we were before, because the essence of the institution, the very core of what matters in a great university, remains true here. That has not gone away. And if we learn the lessons that put us in this position, learn the things that we failed in, we can advance as an institution and be far better than we've ever been in the past.
And as you said, more difficult news does lie ahead. But Rowan, I'd like your comment on leaving us with, how do you feel about, we've got these two images of students, the rioting students and the candlelight vigil students?
Well, I mean, I feel like Penn State's like a family. And if I read somewhere that if you understand how families work, then you're going to understand why the students reacted the way they did. So I realize how we look to other universities and for people that don't live in State College. But I mean, I feel like this is also beneficial for the students here because they have to reexamine what their identity as students is right now. And it's going to allow them to maybe shift their priorities a little bit.
With just about 30 seconds remaining, Michael Barabay, your comment.
Well, I think the faculty can do is double down on the academic side. I mean, I'm actually still feeling, I told my students that I was going to have their papers back by Friday, and I still got to get to them. You know, we got to return to normal in that way.
All right, and as Virgil, Coach Paterno's favorite poet, said, endure the present and watch for better things. And on that note, we're out of time. Thank you to our guests, Damon Sims, Vice President of Student Affairs at Penn State, Michael Barabay, Director of the Institute for Arts and Humanities, and Rowan Nasser, a Penn State undergraduate student and a facilitator in Sam Richards' sociology course, World in Conversation. I'm Patty Satalia, and this is WPSU State College, WPSX Kane.